Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to audio and video content, episode archives, monthly roundtables, a book club, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with $1 a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. What's important to you? What do you value? What makes you happy? No matter how you're currently answering this question, I want to know, would your answers change if you were telling your significant other? A work acquaintance? Your boss? If I were there right now in person with a microphone and camera asking you on the record, would any of those answers change? In reality, the answer is probably yes, right? Of course we don't tell our bosses everything about our off-hours lives. We don't tell our coworkers all the smutty shows we watch or tell our relatives about the things we enjoy that we don't really want grandma asking us about around a holiday table. I'm speaking, of course, about guilty pleasures, the bits of pop culture that are considered silly, juvenile, and are often spoken of with derision. Reality television, pop music, fashion trends. It's rare that these bits of culture are seen as areas of legitimate interest, and rarer still, when they're given serious study and consideration. My guest today hopes to change the discourse around so-called guilty pleasures. Her name is Dr. Eva Burke. She's a lecturer at Trinity College Dublin, and she studies and teaches pop culture. We open our discussion on the topic of guilty pleasures, and Dr. Burke had quite a lot to say on the matter.
I really have an issue with the concept of a guilty pleasure. I hate when people ask me what my guilty pleasures are, because I refuse to feel guilty about anything that I enjoy. I mean, unless it's illegal, and they tend not to be.
I know. I'm fully in agreement, and that's why I love talking to you and interacting with you on social media, because, like, just the entire concept of a guilty pleasure feels so weird, and I don't even know that I've ever truly identified with the phrase guilty pleasure. I mean, I've certainly used it, but, like, it just using that language over and over and over again eventually internalizes that what you're doing is something that you shouldn't be doing.
Yes, like, you should feel bad. You definitely shouldn't tell people about this. I really hate that idea. I love sharing when I'm watching trashies, as you know, trashy stuff on Twitter. We bond over, like, the trashiest of Netflix.
I love trash. What is that, Marie Kondo? I love mess.
I love mess.
I love mess. I love mess.
Mm-hmm. But, like, why should you feel bad about that? I really don't like that people try to, especially because my Twitter is kind of semi-professional. Like, it's not linked to my institutional work, but I do identify myself as an academic. Sometimes people are like, quite judgmental about that, and they're like, well, why would you talk about Selling Sunset or, you know, the shit that I watch on your Twitter account? But to me, that's just, I would not feel even slightly ashamed about talking about that stuff. It's such a part of my life, and like I love it. So yeah.
So what is your field of, like, your specific field of study or your specific field of academia?
So my master's degree was actually on popular literature. So on kind of genre fiction, all different kinds of genres. And then my PhD was specifically on crime fiction. So female-centered crime fiction, which I still love and consume constantly. So I do spend a lot of time, I suppose, working with popular culture anyway, even professionally. That barrier for me has never existed. There's never been a barrier between like stuff I'll talk about professionally and stuff that I will be embarrassed to talk about. I would love to talk about Selling Sunset in a college or in a class. I would love to teach Selling Sunset studies if that were a thing.
I would love to talk about genre fiction as a legitimate field of study, because I feel like the only time I ever hear people talking about genre fiction is people defending genre fiction as a legitimate form of writing. Like people will say, oh, there, this something that made sort of a Twitter discourse this past week. This science fiction novel is great. It transcends science fiction. And what they really mean is it's good for science fiction.
Yeah,
like, you know, like it's, oh gosh, it's so well written, as though science fiction can't be well
written. I see a lot of that, the word transcends, in crime fiction criticism as well. So what they're saying is it's not really a crime novel. It's really good. So we're going to say it's better than your average crime novel. And I really don't like that, because it's so devalues the actual work that goes into creating something like that. And it so devalues the message and the content. Like, there can be so much value, cultural value and artistic value in a work of sci-fi or crime fiction. I really don't. I think things are changing a little bit. Like, since I did my master's, people tend to react with less skepticism when I tell them that I study popular culture and popular fiction. So I think things are changing somewhat. But I did see on Twitter a few weeks ago, somebody tweeted about like reading statistics, I think, in America, and who's reading and how many people are reading. And the figure was quite high. And somebody, I think it was a man, responded, yes, but they're probably skewed by women reading romance novels. And I was like, well, yeah, but they're still people and they're still reading. So what's not clicking? Like, obviously they're still consuming books and reading literature. It's just not something you approve of or you would read, you know? I don't like that.
So that actually gets me towards sort of the crux of why I wanted to talk to you specifically, is that there are certain kinds of arts, certain kinds of media, certain kinds of literature that we hold up as having value, as adding to society, as being real literature. And the thing is, I mean, you know, even being a writer myself and a reader and a lover of the arts and an artist and all of that, you know, I still have to kind of deprogram myself a lot of times from like, oh, sure, I'm a writer, but I'm not like them. You know, I'm an artist, but I'm not like them. And that comparison of, you know, this work is just intrinsically more valuable than this other work. And I wonder, you know, when you study this kind of thing for a living, you know, you teach this kind of thing for a living, how do you parse that out? Because your field of study is mired in genre fiction and pop culture and things like that. How do you begin to approach that with like students, with other academics?
I kind of relate to what you're saying. I still have some of that baggage myself, especially when I was doing my PhD in Dublin. I did my PhD in Trinity College in Dublin, and my peers, a lot of them were studying like James Joyce, or, you know, literature that I suppose we very much consider worth studying, high art. So sometimes there was a little bit of, I suppose, self-doubt on my part that what I was doing was less worthy or less valuable. I have come to terms with this now, and I realize obviously that my work is good in itself, and that the work is good. But yeah, I still had that baggage, and I find that students sometimes have it as well. So they might come to a class like this if we're talking about a romance novel or about a work of crime fiction, expecting it to be very easy. Firstly, I do find that they think it'll be a very easy class, which I don't like, because I think you should always be coming with the expectation that you will be challenged. And also sometimes they will question the value of it. If they're used to studying like W.B. Yeats or, you know, Virginia Woolf, it can be hard to, I suppose, explain or justify why someone like Nora Roberts or Dan Brown is worth talking about in the same classroom. So there is baggage there to unpack, but what I try to do is sort of culturally contextualize it and spend time really looking at why it's important. Because while I think there is obviously value in studying Virginia Woolf or James Joyce, they're not necessarily authors that everybody is reading at present. And I think that whatever is popular currently, because something is popular, that in itself is a starting point for discussion, I think. Like, what is it telling us about our cultural moment? What is it about this that's appealing to us right now? That's where I start from. And usually from there we go and we find, okay, if we're reading like Agatha Christie or something, we can find kind of interwar context, conversations about changing gender roles, things like that. And they do usually come around to the idea that there is value in these texts. Watchmen is a great one. We always do Watchmen, and they love talking about that, because especially in the context of, like, we do have American students who study in Ireland, and they really like the idea of a kind of diverging history, a different history to the history of America, and just conversations about power and control and things like that. So I do find that usually when people properly study and like really get into this, the chip on their shoulder kind of goes away. For some people though, that is always an issue, and it always will be, and I think we just have to coexist with that fact that some people will never value popular culture as a field of study, unfortunately. But it's okay, there's enough of us that do so.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up contextualizing things like Virginia Woolf, James Joyce, you know, Hemingway, et cetera, et cetera. You know, sort of the great names in American literature, or the great names in literature. And, you know, there's a lot of conversation, especially in recent years, where authors, people who want to be authors, you know, writers and stuff say, you know, if you want to write a book in a specific genre, it's great that you have your literary idols, but you need to be reading books that were published in the last 3 years, 5 years. Yeah. How many books have you read that were published in the last year? If you want to be part of this genre, if you want to know what people are, you know, consuming right now, you can't be reading something that was popular 60, 70 years ago. You need to know what the current landscape is, and you need to know that because there are conversations that we've had. There is growth that we've done. Mm-hmm. There are new ways of thinking about people and culture and, you know, all sorts of intersections of identity and stuff that we have done that has now informed what the literature landscape looks like today. So it's great that you have your idol, but you also need to be prepared to meet readers where they are right now.
Yes, I'm always stunned by people who only read the classics or who won't read anything published after the 1940s or 50s. And I have met people like that. And I just don't understand, like, how are you going to, especially if you are aiming to write, how are you going to write about a world that is post 9/11, like post pandemic, and how all of this stuff that has happened in the past, even in the past like 10 years, so much has changed for us as a world. I think you're so right. You have to be reading, you have to be in tune with the cultural conversation, and it's really hard to do that if you're not reading stuff that's coming out right now. But there can be, I think I saw a tweet last week, somebody who was a writer or was giving advice to writers and said, you don't have to be a reader to be a writer. And it caused an awful lot of conversation, because first of all, why would you want to work in this industry if you're not a fan of the product? That doesn't really make sense to me. I don't think I've ever met a writer who who wasn't a reader. It's a very strange idea. But yeah, no, I agree. I think it's fine to aspire to be writing like somebody like Virginia Woolf. But if you're not reading especially what women are writing in 2022, then you're out of step, I think, with that conversation. And I would question your ability to engage with what we're thinking at the minute, because surely that's what writing should be. It should be helping us to reflect.
Do you think that it should be, the conversation should be less about what X, Y, or Z person wrote at this time,
mm-hmm.
and more about why was that important at that time? Because mm-hmm. then you can have a conversation of why is this particular, this new form of media important now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this person wrote this then, and it was important because it said this, it pushed society this way, it created this conversation. And this is now important now, you know, this new voice or this new form of writing or this new form of entertainment or whatever it is important now, you know, instead of focusing on what they did, what happened afterwards, I think is the better conversation.
So looking at a novel or a text as kind of a cultural artifact and how it, I suppose, how it changed things. Yeah, I've done this and it's really fun. Well, it's fun for me. I'm not sure if it's fun for other people. If you go back and look at like the Victorian bestseller lists, it's really funny because you expect to see like Dickens and really famous names, but so many of them are completely forgotten by history. And even 50 years ago, if you look at like bestseller lists from then, so many of them are forgotten. And I think that points to what you're saying, which is the people we remember are not necessarily the people who were best-selling in their time. So it's always interesting to look back at what was popular. There's a Victorian author called Marie Corelli. I think she was the best-selling author of the Victorian period, but very few people like remember or even recognize the name now. And her work it's fine. It's not fantastic. But it's just interesting to look at it as a cultural artifact and see, okay, this is what people were concerned by at the time. This is what people were reading about. This is what people were thinking about. So I would say if anyone is interested in that, just go back and look at the bestseller list. Even 20 years ago, if you look at what was popular, I think you would be surprised at how few names you recognize. I think it's always good. It's like a time capsule into certain periods of anxiety, especially in the world. Yeah,
a time capsule of anxiety. Yeah. I feel like that should be my author bio.
I am also a
time capsule of anxiety.
I think I'm a grenade of anxiety. But yeah, no, it's just interesting because I think we assume that we'll recognize the names that were popular, but it's not necessarily the case. Authors do get forgotten, even having been bestsellers, for whatever reason, whatever they were doing just fell out of fashion or just wasn't popular.
Well, I mean, you know, we know of the concept in music of a mm-hmm. one-hit wonder, right? Mm-hmm. But we, for some reason, don't think that applies to anything else. You know, a mm-hmm. one-hit wonder is a song that comes out, it makes a big splash, it hits number one, or at least, the song of the summer. It's a group or a singer that comes and it's everywhere. And a few years later, you're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like Aqua with Barbie Girl. Like, okay, yeah, that happened.
Yeah, they had like a few other hits here in Europe, and they were quite popular. Yeah. We had bad taste, though.
Or TATU. Do you remember Tattoo?
Yes, the Russians. Oh, yes.
The fake lesbian Russians.
Yeah. Yeah. They went to Eurovision. I think they were in Eurovision a few years later, but they were still doing the fake lesbian thing.
Despite everybody knowing it was fake, like despite it having been exposed. But all of that to say, I think that we think of one-hit wonders as only being in music. And I wish mm-hmm. that we would kind of also think of it as being in other art forms. Because like you mm-hmm. said, go back and look at the bestseller list. You know, mm-hmm. what splashed and, you know, somehow stumbled its way to number one on a bestseller list or even top 10 on a bestseller list doesn't necessarily indicate that it was driving culture forward or something mm-hmm. like that. I mean, a tweet or a statement, an interview by a celebrity that's like, oh yeah, I really like the novel. I'm going to make something up. You know, I really love the novel Pickled Crickets by Jonathan Franzen. And mm-hmm. then suddenly Pickled Crickets is number one. Mm-hmm. It might have been a garbage book, but everybody's mm-hmm. reading Pickled Crickets.
I'm so fascinated, though, by the intersection of, like, what's happening in the world. Like, look at, do you remember when Dan Brown wrote The Da Vinci Code? And there was this,
of course,
there was this rash of, like, conspiracy novels around it. I still enjoy The Da Vinci Code. I'm sorry, I do. I don't feel guilty.
I loved The Da Vinci Code, and mm-hmm. I remember picking it up because I was watching, I think, Kenneth Copeland, one of those, like, TV mm-hmm. you know, faith healer, preacher people. And he was like, if you read this novel, you will go to hell. And I remember him saying that. And I was like, I picked up the book the next day. I was like, that is the best endorsement of all time. Thank you, sir. And it was fun. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a fun book.
Yeah,
did it do anything? No.
It's just fascinating. The hype around that novel really fascinates me, and the sort of the ensuing conversation about conspiracies. Like, so many people, like, genuinely believed that that was not fiction. Like, worryingly believed that that was not fiction.
I forgot about that.
But just something like that, I think, or like even the trends in what's fashionable in fiction, they kind of fascinate me, just to see what's currently popular. Do you remember when paranormal romances were, like, everywhere after Twilight?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, not even after True Blood, you know, mm-hmm. the Sookie Stackhouse mysteries here. It's amazing how books written a long time ago can suddenly find a new mm-hmm. audience and then reset what we're doing. Madeline Miller's Song of Achilles is a really good example of that. It came out, it did nothing. It was found on TikTok 10 years later. A girl threw it at the wall, and suddenly Madeline Miller is now everything she touches is gold.
Yeah.
You know, then Circe comes out, and now Galatea is, you know, they're publishing her short stories in hardcover. And it's just amazing how what impacts culture doesn't necessarily equate to immediate success, you know, raving critical acceptance immediately. Like, mm-hmm. it can take a long time to be appreciated. And there's all sorts of artists and voices and stuff who are very famously not appreciated in their time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they get to live to see themselves become successful, but very often they don't.
It must be the weirdest thing, though, for an author to be sort of, like, quietly successful or just sort of doing okay, and then to have something like that happen, to have your name kind of explode on TikTok or BookTok or whatever they call it. But social media, I think, is an interesting look at how fandom can kind of democratize these things. Mm-hmm. So something that's not necessarily critically valued or not necessarily something that got a lot of critical attention can just explode with ordinary people on Twitter or TikTok, and then it just becomes this massive cultural thing. I'm not sure if you're aware of this kind of cultural critique from the 20s and the 1920s and 30s, the idea of mass culture and mass culture and popular culture being bad for us, being like kind of having a pacifying effect or something that can, like, lull us into.
Sure.
Yeah.
But people still today do that. I mean, it's whatever is popular must be inherently bad because it is popular.
Yes. Or like superhero movies. I mean, yes. I am a fan of Marvel movies. I will say that. And Star Wars. Yeah. And X-Men and everything. But people have this real fear that it's lulling us into sort of not really paying attention to larger issues. And I really feel like that's just so condescending, because it really suggests that we are passive consumers and that we're not able to critically engage with something like that, or that we're not able to just enjoy something for the sake of it. And not everything has to be you know, about a larger cultural project or issue, I think it's okay for something to be escapism. I feel
well, and the thing is, what I think people do is they lose the ability to critique something if it doesn't fall into how they've critiqued things before, if it doesn't align with previously accepted metrics for importance or success, then it cannot be important and it is not successful. Marvel movies are a really good example because, yes, they have become commercially successful things, but I think they have also done a great service to genre stories of all types. Now, I'd like to say up front, you know, for the folks out there that know this kind of thing, they have also made it really hard for like mid-budget movies to get made because everything these days either has to be a tentpole billion-dollar blockbuster or a shoestring budget. So I get that. I fully understand there's nuance here. But as far as the kinds of stories that audiences will show up to watch, Spider-Man No Way Home would never... that would have been weird and unacceptable 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. But what movies like Infinity War and Endgame and No Way Home and even Doctor Strange and WandaVision.
That would never, like 10 years ago. No.
WandaVision being this critical darling and getting Elizabeth Olsen like A-list you know, names on award season shortlists. Like, could you imagine WandaVision being one, accepted, two, understood, and three, supported by audiences 10 years ago, 15 years ago? But this would have been the weird genre show on Sci-Fi that did nothing. It would have been like a cult phenomenon, yeah, like, you know, 15 years ago.
I think the stuff that we see now is stuff that we would have seen on the Sci-Fi channel like 15 years ago. And do you remember Legend of the Seeker?
Sis, we own. Listen.
I loved it.
Listen. Craig Horner, and that's his name, right? The main guy from Legend of the Seeker. Listen. Listen, sis. My husband and I. We have seen every inch of that show. That is a great. That is good.
That is the example, though, I go with when people talk about things like Game of Thrones and Marvel, because they don't remember the struggle. Like, they don't remember being a nerd back then when, like, what we got was really low caliber in terms of quality. It just wasn't there. The budget was not there. Like, my boyfriend always says the first time he watched Game of Thrones, because he's a huge fantasy nerd, he saw the armor and the saddlery that the horses were wearing, and he was like, okay, this actually has budget. Like, they're really going for this. And that did not happen before. Like,
no.
We got scraps. It was not good.
The Xena Hercules Power Hour.
Yes.
We had
the Mystic Knights of Tiernan Oak here in Ireland. I know.
I did a TikTok about that like a year ago, and I was like, I feel like I am the only human being on the face of the planet that remembers this show. I can sing the theme song. I know how all of them summoned their power. I remember all of it. Like, air above me, water before me. Like, listen, earth beneath me, fire within me, baby, forest before me. Like, yes.
Oh, it was...
I wanted that dragon playset so bad.
It was so, like, it wasn't even that popular even in Ireland, but I still remember it so vividly. I think I met one of the guys from it at Dublin Comic Con a few years ago, and he was really surprised that anybody like knew him from that. But we got like scraps. Like, we did not. I think it might be a generational thing as well. Like, people who are like Gen Z maybe don't remember what it was like when nerd culture was still kind of a guilty pleasure, I guess, or something you were supposed to be ashamed of.
It just shocks me how everything that I grew up loving, but everybody else thought was weird, is now like a sign of success, a thing that people do to, like, you know, polish up their resume. I mean, like, people having podcasts as a main source of income or something. Like, you know, like these, like, I'm like, I remember when I started podcasting, like, you were the weirdo. Like, oh, you've got a podcast? Like, do you live in a basement somewhere? You know, like, collecting comics, reading these stories, you know, mm-hmm. like, but getting into the weeds with this stuff. Like, what a comic book movie was when the first Spider-Man movie came out was still a pretty beat by beat hero's journey. But what a comic book movie has become today mm-hmm. can be weird. It can be so weird. What they did on Loki, I mean, it's just
yes.
what you're allowed to do right now.
Did
is
you
so
see,
transformed.
Did you see Legion?
Of course.
Yes, I that one blew my mind because I really didn't yeah. think they would be allowed to. It was very, for superhero TV, it kind of blew my mind that they were allowed to go to some of the places that they went to, just in terms of form, even, and structure and character. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, you're so right. Just things have changed so much. And there's so much intertextuality in comic book movies now and references. And it's just become such a brilliantly... kind of imaginative space that it wasn't. I think maybe they were afraid to go to some of these places in like 2002 or whenever the first Spider-Man movie came out. Like, you kind of knew what mm-hmm. you were going to get. I remember seeing that movie when I would have been like 12 when that movie came out, and knowing what I was going to get even then. But yeah, it's just, I don't think people can appreciate the difference, like what's happened in the past 10 years in terms of these movies and just the wider field of genre fiction and genre on TV. Like, we would never have gotten, you know, the Wheel of Time on TV without Game of Thrones. We would never have got Game of Thrones without Lord of the Rings, you know, just looking at how it's progressed and how much has changed is just astonishing.
So I want to talk about a little bit people that sort of dabble in the realm of commercially acceptable, commercially successful media, while also then turning around and doing stuff that, you know, makes the critics happy, but doesn't really mm-hmm. get them as much visibility or as much widespread acclaim. And I feel like the most famous example of that is somebody that most people don't realize is an example of that, and that is Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Shakespeare's acclaim, if I'm not mistaken, now you're the doctorate in literature, I am not, but from my baby studies in literature, Shakespeare's you know, actual, say, for lack of a better term, like critical success, critical acceptance, were sonnets, mm-hmm. poems. They were these smaller art forms. Shakespeare's plays were like the selling sunset of the day. Like, even the form of English that they were written in was what, like a common, like a low form of the English dialect or something like that. You could speak to that far better than me. But what was going on with Shakespeare?
But yeah, I suppose we think these days of Shakespeare as very high art, and of the people who would have seen the plays performed as maybe upper class or upper middle class. But yeah, it was common art form for ordinary people. As you said, his poetry was much more valued at the time, and his history, so, you know, like his kind of biographical plays about kings and queens, whereas his dramas were far less valued, which I do think points to this ongoing problem of what we see as valuable. If it's teaching us something, it's okay. If it's not teaching us something, if it's pure entertainment, we're a little bit afraid of that. But that larger point about the commercial viability of art and artists who try to, I suppose, balance between making stuff that will get them critical acceptance and making stuff that will pay their bills is visible kind of throughout history, the history of authors. Edgar Allan Poe was a good example of a writer who has written about this, about the need to write trash because he had to pay his bills. And very cynically as well, but it's stuff that we artistically value that work, which makes me think that in like 100 years time, it could be the case that we, maybe not Selling Sunset, but stuff that we see as lower art forms, that there might be some revision where we go back and say, okay, no, this actually is valuable. And just because it was written with a commercial concern or because money needed to be made, that doesn't mean that it's bad. Just, I suppose, what you're talking about there is kind of the implicit classism of the arts, which is an unfortunate thing, but we like to think of creators as kind of above, like, the concerns of life and making art purely for its own sake and because it's beautiful and because they want to. But obviously, you know, as a creator, you know that sometimes it's just work and that's okay. It doesn't always have to be purely artistic endeavor for the sake of beauty. It can just be, okay, I need to put something out, and it can still be good, you know. We're very uncomfortable with that idea, though. Still, we like to think that art should be pure and it shouldn't be contaminated with questions of money or funding. That might be another reason why Marvel and the success of Marvel makes us uncomfortable, because obviously, as you pointed out, it is a genuine industry issue, that movies like Marvel and things like that are kind of dominating. That is a problem. But also we really don't like thinking of art as a commodity. It makes us very uneasy still, I think.
You know, when you talk sort of about the classism of mm-hmm. art and the way in which we think, you know, I think we have it in our heads that certain people appreciate certain kinds of art forms. So therefore, even if they don't, mm-hmm. you know, like we have it in our heads that like a certain kind of person must appreciate a certain kind of art form. Mm-hmm. So we kind of inherently, intrinsically value it as something more important. But, you know, to go back to what makes an impact, what gets people talking, what creates culture almost, mm-hmm. I do want to start talking a little bit about some of those genre shows, things like Supernatural, things like, you know, like you mentioned, Legend of the Secret, you know, some of those shows that kind of create fandoms and followings and stuff like that. Since, you know, your study is in genre fiction and mm-hmm. in that kind of world, what have you seen in studying that art form, those groups, how they react to you know, their thing, mm-hmm. You know, how do you perceive that?
I'm really fascinated by like fandom culture and fandom studies. I'm working on a Murder, She Wrote project at the minute, and we're hoping it will be an edited collection on the show, but we're hoping to interview some of the fans, the biggest fans, just because this is what I'm interested in. Just the relationship between the art and between the fans. Like someone like Terry Pratchett really encouraged that relationship. I know, RIP. I love him so much.
Terry Pratchett is a god.
He used to teach
other people him. Talk about Virginia Woolf and all of that. For me, it's Terry Pratchett.
He used to teach on the masters that I did, but he left before I did it, unfortunately, so I never got to meet him. But by all accounts was just an incredible, wonderful person. But he's somebody that was very encouraging of that relationship between the art and the fans. And I am interested in the idea that it can go both ways and that fans can like affect look at something like Star Wars and the effect that Reddit had on the last Star Wars movie. But there can be a symbiotic relationship there. Whereas other people, I think J.K. Rowling is an example, not to invoke her name too much, but they really have issues with too much fan fiction or with the fans claiming ownership over the product. So it can differ, I think, depending on the creator. Some creators are very welcoming of it. And they really cultivate that fan base and encourage things like fan fiction and headcanons and things. I think it depends on our perception of what art is and who it belongs to. I very much believe that something popular belongs to the fans. Obviously not legally in terms of copyright. I think it's fine for the author to own copyright, but I really think fans should be encouraged to engage with these universes and create fan fiction and their own. Like I am a fan fiction fan. I think it can be a really nice kind of universe expanding thing. But I was having this conversation recently with somebody about The Great Gatsby. I think the copyright on The Great Gatsby is up this year. She's writing on queer representations in the novel, and apparently the Fitzgerald estate has been very protective of the estate and very against any queering of the characters or the text. But there's, it thrives in fan fiction. Like, there's a huge subculture of fan fiction.
Sure.
Like web comics and people writing stories who really lean into that. And I think stuff like that can be fascinating and really, I think, challenges the idea that popular culture is passive or that it makes us passive. I think it can be, popular culture can be whatever we make it. It can be a space for queering. It can be a space for rebellion and for challenging ideas. It just depends on what we're doing with it, if that makes sense.
You know, now there is a space at which I think the ownership that fans feel over a thing goes overboard.
It can become toxic, yes.
Yeah, it can become quite toxic. You know, I talked to Joshua Conkle, who was a writer behind Chilling Adventures of Sabrina and a series of unfortunate events, the adaptations of both of those. And, you know, just kind of talking about how fans can go too far in their feelings of ownership of certain pieces of media. They'll create these headcanons. They'll create these ships with certain characters. And when they don't see them then reflected in the story that the writers were already writing and filming a year ago, you know, or 2 years ago, or however long this was made, or basing it on the source material or whatever it is, how just angry they get. And I don't, I think there still needs to be a space for storytellers to tell their story. And if you want to go tell a story, you go tell that story.
Exactly. I think that people need to, I think there is a line as a fan where you can say, okay, this is what I want it to be. This is what I enjoy, but it's okay if the creators of the show are going in a different direction. Like something, Game of Thrones, I think, is a good example. That last season had a lot of weird fan service. The final Star Wars movie, again, I think was a corrective to The Last Jedi, which I loved. I loved The Last Jedi. I thought it was very brave. But yeah, I think you're right. It can become, especially in an age where we have so much input from everybody all the time. Like there's a constant stream of voices on Reddit and Twitter and TikTok. And I'm sure as a creator, it's very hard to ignore that. Or to think, okay, this is really what people want, so maybe I should do this. And there is very much a sense of entitlement. Like George R. R. Martin obviously famously hasn't finished his series, and it is a point of contention for fans. I am a huge fan and I do want him to finish the series, but there are people who will go on his blog and just spam comments and say things like, well, you're going to die soon, so you should be finishing, you should be writing your book. Like, I don't understand why people think that's okay or that they're entitled to say things like that to creators. That makes me very uncomfortable.
It makes me very uncomfortable as a writer of books and as a person who puts media out in the world, because something I had to learn, other friends of mine who are farther along in their authorial careers, when I was about to have my debut, they said, now you're going to need to block Goodreads, don't go look at the reviews on Amazon, you know, because reviews are not there for you. You need to tune out what other people say. Not because you should absolve yourself of any criticism or anything like that, but you are going to hyper focus on the one person who just really hated the thing you put out in the world. And you're going to ignore the hundreds of people, the thousands of people that loved what you put out in the world. And then there's people that just don't even know what a review is supposed to be. You know,
they're like, I bought this for my grandson and he hated it. Okay.
Right. Or, you know, on Amazon, you'll see reviews where it's like, you know, oh, the box came wet, one star. It's like, well, that's, is that really adding to the way that reader, I mean, that's, that readers will see, oh, it's got 6 one-star reviews. And if all of them are about shipping, is that really about the book? Is that fair? But like, it's funny, you know, talking about reviews and the way that audiences relate to things and the way that we focus on such bad reviews. It's so interesting because, you know, not reading mine, but just going and reading reviews of almost any book, you know, when you go read the middling to negative reviews, they just seem to get less and less about the book itself,
yes,
and more about what the reader wanted the book to be instead.
I think though you could have put your finger on something which is a problem with what, like, we've talked there about people being uncomfortable with the idea of art as commodity. And I think when we do perceive when we do perceive art as a commodity, I think people get this entitlement or sense that, like, you work for them as a creator, that they're paying you money to work for them, so you should be doing what you're told. That's become very common in fan cultures. Like, I want this, so it should be happening now. So yeah, I think you're right. And I have seen Amazon reviews in particular that are just incoherent rants about, like, larger problems that the person has, or problems with the genre. They're not really specific to the actual book. It just makes me wonder though if things like Amazon and Goodreads have become incredibly toxic for authors, because so much of it, of your success is reliant on these reviews, and fans, those kinds of toxic fans, can have a lot of power and control that they really shouldn't have in this kind of landscape. So I'm actually not a fan of Goodreads. I own a Kindle, and I download books from Amazon, but I do try to avoid it as much as I can, because I don't like that the marketplace where it's like, well, this book has 6 negative reviews, so I probably shouldn't buy it. Or you know, as you say, when you read that, when you actually read the reviews, they're not informed or intelligent at all. They're just ranting or just nonsense. Like, that makes me uncomfortable that the success of creators is kind of dependent on that kind of metric these days. I really don't like that.
Yeah, I don't either.
But I can imagine.
It's so hard because so many people are thinking that they are participating in a system that is helpful. I don't know. I still think that people think they're being helpful. But what we, you know, something that a friend of mine who worked in radio for many years told me years before I ever thought that I could ever write any book, let alone multiple books, was what she learned from being a radio DJ is that people typically only call in if they're mad about something. And they very rarely call in. She was like, you know, it's funny because even when we host contests, like radio contests or something like that, far less people participate in those than you think they would, there would be, you know, far less people call in to do anything, you know, to share a story or to whatever. But if you want to let somebody complain, people will complain.
Oh my gosh.
All day.
Okay.
But it's harder to get people to come and say why they liked something.
I need to tell you about this Irish DJ. I'm not sure if you've heard of this man. His name is Joe Duffy. Okay. He's a very successful older radio broadcaster here in Ireland. And his daily show is literally just complaints. Like, he picks a topic. So it might be like sex on TV, or, you know, the paramedics in Ireland aren't responding as quickly as they should, something like that. And then he'll just get people to call in, and it's so popular, especially with older people. They will just call in and just rant, and they absolutely love it. It's just, I can't listen to it because it's absolutely awful, but it's just this really weird conservative whingy thing where people just really like to be angry publicly and share their anger with other people and talk about how angry they are and how disappointed they are. And I think your friend is completely right. This is a perfect example of that, of just like airing your grievances. People just really love doing that. I'm not sure why, to be honest. My rule for reviews, I only put reviews on book reviews on Twitter, but my rule is that I won't leave a bad review. So if I didn't like something, I just won't review it, or I just won't talk about it. Whereas if I liked it, I will talk about it, because I think, you know, that's just my opinion. So
one of the things that I think is just so weird about sort of online comment section, review section culture, I guess, if there is a culture, is going and looking at people that leave these, you know, like these kinds of reviews that we're talking about, these reviews that almost have nothing to do with the book itself or whatever. And you go, because you can actually see, I'm just so curious sometimes, I'll, you know, I don't know, I'm looking up a cookbook for Anthony Porofsky or something, and you go and you look at the reviews to see, you know, or whatever, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. And you go and you look, well, you can actually see, like, you know, if you're commenting on Goodreads, you've got a profile. Mm. So sometimes I'll just click and I'll see, oh, this person's reviewed 700 books and their average rating is like a 2.9 or a 3.0. Yep. And I'm like, oh, so you just hate books.
Yes, I do, like, that as well. Because I want to
you
know.
You just hate reading. Like, just say that.
Yeah. It's so weird. Like, because there are people on Amazon I've seen who just make a career out of, like, bad reviews. Like, I remember when Twilight.
Bad reviews.
Giving bad reviews. Like, I remember when Twilight was popular. I liked the first Twilight book, I must admit, when it came out. I was young.
A lot of people did. It sold a lot of copies.
Yeah, I am happy that we're having some kind of revision on Twilight. I still don't think the series is good, but I do think that the fans got an awful lot of undeserved shit for being kind of young women who liked a romance novel. But I remember,
oh my god, young women who like things. People hate young women who
How
like things.
How dare they? One Direction.
How dare young women like things?
No, sure. They're not allowed. But I remember when that, like, the hate for Twilight became a huge internet phenomenon. There were, like, entire websites dedicated to bad reviews. And, like, if you went on Amazon, there would just be people, like, repeatedly just giving bad reviews to the books. And it was so strange because they weren't enjoying it. And they also weren't, like, enjoying it and hating it at the same time. They were just enjoying hating it. It was really...
Exactly.
Just something I've never seen before. Like, they were really taking pleasure in, like, venting at this thing that was, like, obviously not good, but, you know, you could just ignore it. You don't have to be on a website talking about how much you hate it. That's kind of weird in retrospect, you know?
Going back to a point that, you know, we kind of circled around earlier, just sort of the value that we place on different types of media. Mm-hmm. I have always, and I, you know, I have just personally felt like the best dramatic actors are comedians, are comic actors, people who are famously comic actors. I think Robin Williams is a fantastic example of that.
Yes.
Melissa McCarthy just recently had, you know, a few years ago, had a wonderful turn that landed her an Oscar nomination. Forget the title of the movie. Can You Ever Forgive Me or something like that?
And yes, that. I think that was it. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, when you talk to actors, when you, you know, listen to interviews, watch interviews, that kind of thing, dramatic actors will tell you, oh, it's so much harder to be a comic actor. That timing, that ability to make somebody laugh, it's easier to make somebody cry. It's easy to sit there and go into these dark places because that's kind of what we value that in acting. But, like, Leonardo DiCaprio could not make me laugh if he tried.
I feel the same way. It's just so much harder to make people, like, I would take Will Ferrell any day over Leonardo DiCaprio.
Okay, now,
you know what I mean?
That's, see, now.
I know you're not a huge fan.
I am sorry. I'm sorry to all of the Will Fannels out there. He's not my jam. Now, that being said, the movie with him and Maggie Gyllenhaal, the you know,
the writer, what was it called?
Yes. That is easily his best movie ever. And it's a truly great film, but it is because he's not doing that thing. Like, Jim Carrey did the same thing. Like,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he did Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and proved my theory correct.
No, I think you're right, though. I do think that being successful comedically is always harder. It's the same with horror. Like, I find horror movies are culturally undervalued because we don't really value...
Talk to me about horror. When people talk about underappreciated genre fiction or underappreciated genre films, horror is always at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. I, as you probably know, am not a huge horror fan.
Mm-hmm.
I do not like to be scared. I don't want to be scared. And I am much more willing to sit there and escape into a very silly comedy with a very stupid premise than I am a very stupid horror movie with a very stupid premise. It's not escapist for me. What am I missing in a horror fiction What am I getting wrong? How can I appreciate horror more?
Okay, so for me, it's less about being scared. Like, it's not necessarily that I want to be scared. Sometimes if it's something really jumpy or fun, that's okay. Like in a roller coaster way, you know, it's scary, but you know, you're not really in danger. But with really good horror, I think what I get from it is just, I think just some reflection on like fear in general, or the idea of fear or anxiety. Maybe that's it for me. Like for a long time, I wasn't a horror fan. I was a real wuss. It was only in my kind of early 20s that I started getting into horror as a genre. And I just find that it raised a lot of questions about power and fear and anxiety. Something like Hereditary, for example, which I know you did not like. I loved, just because
bad movie. It is a bad
it's
movie.
Not, it is not no a sense. Bad movie.
No, it makes, there is no it narrative makes structure so to that movie. Sense. The ending makes absolutely no sense with the rest of the movie. It is bad. Toni Collette deserves better. Toni Collette in Knives Out was the one who should have gotten the nomination, not the Toni Collette. No. Okay. Midsommar taught me that Ari Aster can write, but Hereditary, no. No.
I cannot. I just can't disagree more. I love Hereditary. I could talk all day about it. I won't, but something like that. Something like that is an example, because it didn't scare me. I wasn't scared, but it just
there's nothing to be scared about. It's just weird.
But there was just this sense of like dread throughout, which I found fascinating. And for a genre, okay, but for a different horror movie, we'll say, for something like that to inspire that feeling in me is something I don't really get from a lot of other genres. So that could be it for me. I teach gothic fiction sometimes and horror, and sometimes people are very averse to it. Like I think horror is the kind of genre where if you're not a fan, you're really not a fan. People don't really dabble in horror as much. It's just something that you either really like or you really don't like. But I just find it can be a really good space to work myself up to it.
Like if there's a horror movie that everybody's watching, I can work myself up to watch it. Like I worked myself into watching Hereditary. And I think that's why I get so upset when I hate it, because I'm just like, listen, I mentally prepared, I spiritually prepared, I cleaned my, you know, I got ready. And that it was like The Ring. By the time I finally watched The Ring, I was like, this is bad. I guess it was entertaining, or the Blair Witch Project back in the day. Like I was like, well, I guess it's entertaining, but it's not scary.
I'm not a fan of the Blair Witch movies. I actually don't really like the American found footage movies, like Paranormal Activity. They don't scare me. So they don't scare me, and I don't get anything from them. So from a horror movie, I either want to be scared in a fun way, or I want to have some larger engagement with, like, you know, a cultural anxiety or something like that. So I have to get something like that. It can't just be people wandering around a forest for 2 hours. I get nothing from that. That just annoyed me. But I am a huge horror fan now. It took time. Like, it was a process of becoming a horror fan. So it might still happen for you if you desire it, if you pursue it. But
tell you what,
like
if you will send me a watch list,
I will watch the watch list. Okay, I will put together a watch list of really good horror. Although since we disagree
maybe
on Hereditary,
we could do like a Patreon exclusive. Maybe we'll put together a watch list, and like maybe we can have you back on, and we'll just do a Patreon exclusive of like we'll just redo the watch list and have a discussion about those movies. How's that?
That would be really good. Like, have you seen have you seen The Witch? Robert Eggers' film, The Witch.
I own The Witch. It's a great movie.
Yes. And see, that's a good horror movie, and you appreciate it as a good horror movie.
It's a great movie. I almost don't even know that it's a horror movie. That strikes me more as like a gothic movie because of just sort of the imminent sense of dread in the entire thing. I don't even... Is that horror?
It is. I mean, I can't separate out gothic from horror. They are linked. But no, I think it absolutely is horror. Like you're feeling horror when you're watching it, and that's horror.
Sure.
But something like that, it would be an example, I think, of a horror movie that didn't necessarily scare me. Like I wasn't terrified watching it, but
Yeah, I was. There's no, was in there's dread. No scary. There's no jumps. There's no slasher except for the baby.
Yeah, but like there is this, like you feel the dread. There's something really wrong. I think that wrongness is what I enjoy about horror. That there's something. I'm not sure, something that can't almost be expressed, but you feel it. You don't get that from other. I don't get that from a lot of other genres.
Speaking of wrongness that we both enjoy, can we talk about the value of reality television?
Oh gosh, yes.
Because we, I mean, that's I think how we found each other on social media is just like talking about Drag Race and Selling Sunset and just all of the, just the trashiest reality television. What, I mean, is that genre? Is that, you know, is Too Hot to Handle telling us something? I will still defend the first season of The Circle as a great sociological experiment.
I love The Circle.
Seasons have gotten progressively stupider, but the original season of The Circle was just such a cool, sometimes heartbreaking sociological experiment that I loved.
I agree. I think The Circle is really good TV. Like, as you said, it has gotten stupider with like twists and like people playing stupid games, but it's still a really good concept for a TV show, as I think Big Brother originally was. But I mean, I think reality TV is the final frontier for genre studies, for like making, I suppose, having a conversation about whether something is valuable or not. Like, I mean, is Too Hot to Handle telling us something about ourselves or about society? I'm not sure. Like, I'm not finished the third. I still have one episode left of the third series, so there might be a huge cultural revelation.
Oh, I haven't watched this latest season.
Is it
worth it?
No, it's not good. I mean, yeah, it's like they made a photocopy of the first season and it's just fading. It's just, no, it's not. I would miss it.
Some of these shows, once they've been at, well, like if they have a weird, tricky, you know, The Circle, the original Too Hot to Handle, you know, when they have the first one that I remember seeing like this, that they could never do again, so they didn't, was The Mole. Mm-hmm. Do you remember The Mole?
Yes, I never watched it. I've heard of it.
Oh my god! Okay, so The Mole, I think it's available on Netflix now, or Hulu, or one of the streamers. Go watch it. Anderson Cooper hosts it, and the entire concept is, it was sort of a combination of Survivor and The Amazing Race, almost. Mm-hmm. Like, they had a group of people, and they're all working, you know, they're all set, you know, they're given tasks to do. And, you know, obviously there's a cash prize at the end, and the more successful you are, the more money you get, and blah, 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 blah. But the trick to The Mole was there was a mole. There was one person amongst the group who was there, sent there by the producers to undermine the tasks, to undermine the work of everybody else. And you were trying every week to vote off the mole to try to figure out who was the person undermining it. So you're putting this, you know, psychological sense of unease and distrust immediately. You don't immediately reveal that there's a mole. You tell somebody later on. But then it sets the, you know, it's that Lord of the Flies, you know, the paranoia sets in kind of thing. And it created this whole extra level of storytelling. But the problem with The Mole wasn't that it wasn't a good show. It was that once you did it,
You couldn't do it again.
You can't do it again and come up with the same thing, at least not without trying to throw a ton of new twists in that take away from what the show did. So it didn't do it. They did one season and that was it, and it was great. And I feel like even shows like The Circle, Too Hot to Handle, that we think of as silly, their original seasons, I think, tell us something about ourselves. Sometimes, like even like old seasons of like The Bachelor, like they, you know, The Bachelor asks, what is attraction? What is love? Can, you know, that kind of thing. The Circle tells us, you know, who are we really behind our profile picture? You know, discussions of personal value and worth and, you know, the economy of body politics and the way that you value your own body and presentation in the world. you know, the catfishes, like, oh my gosh, they were the most amazing part of the original season of The Circle.
Yeah, that question of identity and whether it matters to you if a person that you think you know is not who you thought they were. I agree. And too hard to handle, even the idea that we can, I suppose, build relationships without, it's a bit stupider, but build relationships without physical contact or without building a sexual relationship.
Too hot to handle, I think, wants to be taken seriously.
Yes.
And it just, come on. Like, it's, come on.
Like, what I think it has the same problem, though, as what you talked about, which is the first season kind of worked because they had no idea what was going to happen. But
exactly.
Subsequently, it's very apparent that they know what show they're on and they're acting like they don't know is really fake. And they're like, oh, yeah, we set up a fake reality show and they think they're on this reality show. But obviously they don't think that. They know they're on Too Hot to Handle. They're not that stupid. Yeah. So it's just, I can't buy into that premise. So, I can't enjoy it. But I think you're right. I think that reality TV can be, it can tell us things about ourselves. And it can also just be very entertaining, which is, that's a value in itself. But it depends. Like something like Selling Sunset is, I suppose, more narrativized version of reality TV. And it's more akin to like a soap opera at times than to like reality. Like the most recent season, I think, was just everybody fighting with Christine.
Yeah. And I wonder, because, you know, I watch the show, I enjoy the show, but I wonder, I even sometimes have to sit back and say, what is it about this that I'm enjoying? Because I get that for a lot of those kinds of shows, a Keeping Up with the Kardashians, a Selling Sunset, even, you know, the Osbournes sort of started this sort of genre of reality TV just sort of being the story of us, a heightened version of this group of people, you know, Real Housewives, that kind of thing, where it, over the years, we've learned that it's contrived. You know, there are writers. If you look in the credits, there's writers. why does a reality show need writers? You know, they help kind of create scenes, or if something happened off camera, they'll help to like recreate it so that it can be captured on camera. That kind of thing. Like, we know that that's happening. But I also wonder what it's doing to us, because these are still real people. And as much as it's contrived, it's also not. There's this weird balancing act. And, you know, I feel that way as somebody that puts himself out there in that content creator world as well, where it's like there's a version of myself that is the person that you all are consuming this content from. And I'm like, but that's not me. So there's, I wonder what it's doing to us, because the audience for these shows, it's like, oh, you know, I love Christine because she's just gonna, you know, the show is Christine. And I'm like, what does it say about us that the show is Christine? Because Christine is just saying terrible things to, I mean, just awful things.
She's basically a monster at this stage. She's just a terrible person. And like, is not even trying to hide or pretend that she's not, like, she's openly a terrible person. But I think, yeah, that's an interesting question, I suppose, about the conjunction of social media and reality TV as well, because we're all living in a world now where we have these like avatars of ourselves, these social media versions of ourselves, where you're not posting your, you know, your worst day or your really shit news. It's always good news, and it's always, you know, the best version of yourself that you're putting forward. And I'm wondering if reality TV has almost like trained us to do that, because, you know, on social media, there's always a do-over. You can always delete, you can always redo, you can always filter. And something like the Kardashians, I think the early seasons of the Kardashians are a good example of that, of like narrativizing yourself and making yourself into a better, like they've physically made themselves into better versions. Like, they're not the same people that they were. Like, they're physically not this, like Khloe Kardashian is a different person to the person she was 6 months ago. It's just hard. It's really hard to keep up.
And it's interesting that you bring up Khloe, because why people related to Khloe 10 years ago is gone. It's gone. You know, Khloe was just the the person who wasn't the supermodel in this family of supermodels.
She was like a real person. Yeah.
She looked like a real person. She had a real person's face. Mm. And, you know, she had a real person's body. And and as much as Kim's body sort of changed how everybody valued the butt and stuff, you know, the curves, it's just like people still very much valued Chloe for these pretty big, substantial, real reasons. Like, we're talking about, you know, the realness of reality TV. People valued her for a very real, legitimate reason. They saw themselves reflected, at least in part, in her. And she systematically destroyed that person.
Yes, like, really physically deconstructed and built herself back up into the ideal Kardashian, which is terrifying. It's like the monster is eating itself. Like, they're, because she has talked about on social media, she has talked about feeling very insecure about her body. And to me, she doesn't seem to be aware of the link between their creation of that standard and her reaction to it, you know?
Exactly.
That's really fascinating.
They created this impossible body standard that the fans absorbed, turned into an entire brand, an economy, a way of living, a lifestyle. And then she then became the consumer of that product that they created. It's so weird.
It's so weird because she posted this whole rant on Instagram about how she's felt insecure about her body and just really did not seem to see any connection between like the years of Kardashian conditioning that we've undergone and how she feels, or how she doesn't want to see that self reflected back, which is really sad. Really, really sad, actually. And just the idea that we had this relatable person, or at least somebody relatable in that world, that's gone now and has become victim to that standard is really intriguing. But yeah, I do think the Kardashians as an early example are fascinating. An example of that best self and like filtering everything and making sure that even your real moments are kind of scripted, and like everything we see, even the fights that we see on the Kardashians TV show are kind of heavily directed and filtered, and we're not, you know, we're not really seeing what goes on behind closed doors. I'm actually not really a fan of the Kardashians just because
I feel like everything I know about them has been against my will.
Yeah, same. I've never sought out the Kardashians, but just I don't really like what they represent or stand for, and I don't like what they've done. But they still fascinate me because if you watch their clips, they're almost like androids. Like, they're just these really beautiful women, but they're just saying, they're talking, but there's no meaning in what they're saying. And they kind of inhabit these massive white houses that are like museums, and they don't eat, or when they do eat, it's salad and nothing else. And it's just, there's something very surreal about them as characters, or like as types to me. They're almost like a simulacrum of humanity. Like, they're not really real. There's some weird unattainable thing that we like observing, like animals in a zoo, or I don't know. They're very strange. They make me very, I don't want to say uncomfortable, but I'm just fascinated by them in the same way that I would be fascinated by like a rare animal. They're very strange.
You know, a show that I know that we both love, that I feel like is the opposite of that. It is a subculture. It is a community using a tool to drive conversation, to create change in an often silly way, but it's helping to humanize people is shows like Drag Race, which, you know, you combine Drag Race and Pose, and we got that HBO Max show about ballroom culture, which is phenomenal. But I think it's so interesting how shows like that have normalized culture that was reviled.
Oh, just absolutely.
Utterly reviled, because it shows at least enough of the human side of this culture that people are, I don't want to say desensitized to it, but just it's you know, it's that in-group out-group dynamic. You know, the out-group is no longer quite so out there anymore.
Yep. I know people people will often shit on Drag Race for kind of mainstreaming drag, or for what they think of as kind of undervaluing or devaluing it. But the work that Drag Race has done in terms of representation in the past 10 years, like, I 10 years ago when I was watching Drag Race, I had like straight roommates who would not watch with me, who mm-hmm. were just perplexed or disgusted by the idea of it. These days, it's so mainstream. It's so normalized. It's so accepted in a way that I don't think they actually get enough credit. I know people complain about like Emmys and Drag Race getting Emmys and stuff and becoming far more mainstream than it has been. But that's so huge just for, as you say, for what it's done for other kind of reality shows that focus on similar things, just for like humanizing people that previously just did not have just didn't have the privilege of being humanized on reality TV. Like, look at what was happening, you know, even 15 years ago on things like, you know, America's Next Top Model or American talk shows. Like, people who were trans or non-binary or in any way diverged from heteronormativity were not humanized on reality TV. They were just were not people. They were not seen as people. And Drag Race has done so much work for that, for... like you said, for just showing us the real stories of people who don't really inhabit that gender binary or who don't fit with that heteronormative ideal. And it makes me laugh how the first season of Drag Race and the early seasons kind of took a lot of inspiration from Top Model, but like really built on that and built something incredibly important and significant. And it's become so self-referential. I'm such a huge fan of Drag Race. I'm such a huge advocate for Drag Race, but I really think we almost don't even have perspective on how much has changed because of Drag Race, because of RuPaul, who obviously has done a lot of kind of problematic things apart from Drag Race that people are, it's okay if people want to call RuPaul out for that, but just the work that Drag Race has done, like here in Ireland, the idea that a TV show like that would be on TV here is astonishing. I mean, even I think in the mid 90s, up until like the early mid 90s, it wasn't even legal to be gay in Ireland, or 80s. I think we do have to pause to appreciate how astonishing that moment is, how far we've come. Like there's going to be a Drag Race Brazil. Like for somewhere like Brazil, that's massive. Just to think that people like that will be represented on TV has just doesn't happen in certain places. So you're absolutely right. And I think make a really good point about what these kind of cultural reflections can do for us, what it can do for us to see people like that on TV, even if it is scripted, even if it's not entirely real. It's still important. And yeah, for me, Drag Race is like the anti-Kardashians. It's reality TV that has helped us progress culturally in a way that just the Kardashians have just not.
Just because it's not even a mainstream comedy or a mainstream drama, mm-hmm. I feel like genre fiction, genre stories, even reality shows as its own kind of genre, subculture or whatever, that's where queer people, underrepresented minority, and that's where they've seen themselves. That's where those boundaries have been broken. And I think that's why it continues to be important. Dr. Eva Burke, I could talk to you for a million years, and I can't wait to do it because we absolutely have to do a follow-up about horror movies. But if people want to contact you, if people want to follow you and follow your thoughts on grand high literature or whatever Christine is doing on Selling Sunset, where can they do that?
They can do that on Twitter. My Twitter is EVA_B89. I am also on academia.edu. If you Google my name, I should come up. And I'm actually also on TikTok, but for me that's mostly just a scrolling platform, but there I do put up cat videos, so you can find a link to my TikTok on my Twitter if you're interested in seeing videos of my cat. Thank you so much, this was so fun, and I really do want to do a follow-up on horror because I think we can.
I will do it. I will not be a baby, I will not be a wimp, I will watch, give me like the top five, like a baby. Okay. A baby person who doesn't love horror, who hated Hereditary. Don't put that on the list.
Okay. No, my best friend hated Hereditary as well.
I liked Midsommar. Mm-hmm. So, like, I can be saved, I feel like. Right. So, you know, put together that list. So. We'll make it a Patreon exclusive, and we'll do a follow-up there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. This was so fun.
Head on Fire is a search for answers to life's biggest and smallest questions.
Today we asked, should you feel guilty about your pleasures? What's the value of pop culture? And can you find importance and merit in areas like reality television and pop literature and more? I hope that if you didn't come away with any definite answers, you at least have a framework for finding those answers, for seeking more information, and for unpacking and interrogating the way that you interact with pop culture, with the things that are popular. I want to say thanks so, so much to my guest, Dr. Eva Burke. I do hope that you all go follow her because I love interacting with her on social media. When this episode is coming out, we are deep in Twitter discussions about the latest season of Love is Blind. And let me tell you, it is such fun getting to read her tweets about this show. Anyways, if you like this show and you'd like to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Share it with your friends on social media. You can also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get the show. And consider leaving a review. Even something as just a string of happy emojis will make the algorithm happy and help suggest the show to other people like you. If you like the show enough and you have some coins to spare, you can keep the show free and producing regularly by joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and a monthly book club. This month, we are wrapping up The Know-It-All by A.J. Jacobs, and next month, we are reading Stiff by Mary Roach. It's a really interesting sort of look at what happens to our bodies after we die. You can sign up for that at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Or if a one-time donation is more your speed, you can buy me a coffee at ko-fi.com/headonfirepod. You can also connect with me on social media at headonfirepod, pretty much everywhere. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Thanks so much for going on this journey with me. And remember, there should be nothing guilty about your pleasures.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.